Get ready to rumble. Shilling Show Unleashed on the Seven Thunders Media Network. Former city councilor, husband, father, and community watchdog. Your host, Rob Shilling.
Welcome to the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Remember, your direct support makes our show possible, and you can directly support this podcast by visiting shillingshow.com and then clicking on the Patreon banner at the top of the page to make a monthly contribution. We appreciate your support.
Shilling Show Unleashed podcast welcomes Catherine Ruth Pakolik, who received her doctorate in economics from Harvard University. She's an associate professor of social research and economic thought in the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America, the mother of eight children, and author of the new book, Hannah's Children, The Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth. Catherine, thank you for joining us today on the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast.
You're welcome. So pleased to be here.
I'd like to talk just briefly about the Bible's Hannah, because certainly she's referenced in the book, and why she was an inspiration here.
The Bible's Hannah has become the archetype from my research perspective for the women that I profile. She's got such an interesting story, and a story that I confess I didn't know completely when I began this research. Like I think many ordinary Americans, I knew about Samuel, loved the story of Samuel and Hannah receiving Samuel as a testimony to her faith and her trust in God and her consistent prayer, right? And Samuel is such a beautiful story, but I did not remember, or if I ever learned, that after she brought Samuel back to live in the service of God, Eli and the Lord took pity on her and were moved by her faith. And then she went home and received five more children. She could see five more children. So Hannah, we remember as the mother of Samuel, but she really had a large family.
Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to pursue this book, because certainly it was a lot of work. I'm sure it was a joyful work, but to find and interview these women and talk to them about their own stories.
Basically, it's a study in contrast. I had been trained as a sort of a mainstream academic economist because of my background and my upbringing, very interested in questions related to population and demographics. So on the one side, I had been reading the literature about falling birth rates and how not just American families are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, but around the world, these numbers are getting, we say lowest low, I mean, to points where people didn't think people would have so few children. We really didn't understand that. So got this world of secular elite demographers all around the world puzzling, scratching their heads, saying, we cannot understand why birth rates could go this low. What could be going wrong? Why don't people want to have children, you know? And on the other hand, I was raised in a large family. My husband and I got married when I was young in graduate school. We were delighted to have children. We were hoping we would be blessed with children. We did. So, you know, families tend to find each other through churches and so on. So I knew there were many families around the country joyfully having, well, let's just say more than 1.6 children. And so I just, at some point I thought, is there anything that this reality of, you know, Christian, Jewish households around the country having more than 1.6 children, can this bring anything to this conversation? You know, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, yeah, you know, this is probably worth doing. This is worth going around to sort of find out what are the things people think about children? What are the things they think about their marriages? What are the habits that they've adopted in their lives, the worldviews? What do they do? Why are they different? And are those differences the kind of differences that the country and indeed people around the world should be thinking about as they puzzle over the question of falling birth rates?
I'm very curious. You referenced that you came from a large family and you have a large family, but is there any correlation or any inverse correlation between people who were raised in large families and then go on to have them?
There's actually very little research, statistical research, on that question, in part because really, you know, seemingly large families, you know, four, five, six children, they're so rare. Mm. But in my study, which was not a representative sample, but it was a large enough sample, I expected to find that most of the women who had larger families in my study maybe disproportionately came from larger families. But in fact, I think more than half of my study sample did not themselves come from large families. So many did. I mean, I think it was over 40% came from larger families. I think over 50% came from smaller homes, you know, no siblings, one sibling. And for some of them, you know, a particular conversion experience was part of changing their mindset about having children. But for others of them, a very explicit statement of, it was lonely growing up, or I looked at other people in large families and thought, that's really lovely. I would like that. Yeah, so it wasn't universal that we all came from large families.
I'd like to talk about your own considerations. You have a large family of 8 children, which is rather unusual. And I'm sure a huge blessing to you, but how did you get there? Yeah. How did you decide this is what you wanted to do?
I said, I did grow up in a large family, so I was looking forward to having children. I mean, I didn't have any, you know, specific goal in mind. I didn't think, you know, I'd really like to have 10 kids or anything. But I was open to having children. So when we got married, and even though I was, you know, young for today's standards, I was 23. I thought, well, you know, we're not going to wait. We're certainly going to see if God will bless us with a child. I should go ahead and say that my husband was a widower when we got married, and he had had 6 children with his first wife. You know, the way he likes to put it is, we had 6 children who were grieving at different ages after losing their mother. I encountered this in my interviews as well, that, you know, when you lose somebody very dear, you know, in some sense, life is never as precious. So, you know, so people asked him, well, how did you want to get married and have children right away again? You just lost your wife. But in fact, it seems to often work in reverse, that you find life more precious, you know, sometimes when faced with loss. So in any case, we got married and we thought, well, it'd be really great to welcome a child if God sends us a child. And we did. We had a child within a year of getting married. You know, and I just got to say, we just enjoyed him so much. Within a couple more months, I noticed what a profound blessing he was, not just to my husband and to me, but to our grieving children who were at different stages of trying to heal from losing their mom. And that was a really interesting lesson to me. People had said, you know, it might be traumatic for your children to welcome a baby right away. Maybe you should wait. But watching how the baby that we were able to bring into our marriage was just an unadulterated blessing, a source of healing. I mean, that really, in a sense, it kind of relaxed me. I thought, well, we can just let the blessings come, right? Because if God sends us more children, it's not going to be a problem. We're just going to enjoy these babies so much. And, you know, so we just welcome babies at that point. Super blessed. So, so that's how we ended up with 8.
So I'm very curious in your research, Catherine, about people's concerns over economics and affordability. I've heard people talking about not even having one kid because, quote, diapers are so expensive. You know, you hear that kind of conversation. I'm sure you did as well.
Yeah, so I want to be delicate here. So when I say delicate, what I mean is, you know, I wouldn't want to ever dismiss any one family's financial hardships because financial hardships come and they're real. I grew up with a dad who worked, you know, sometimes 2 jobs and not easy jobs, and we had a large family. So I want to be delicate. I'm not about to say that real financial hardships don't exist. But if we take a step back and we think about the macroeconomic situation, it can't be the case that falling birth rates are a function of costs, because absolutely everything in the modern world is more accessible to us than in the past. We've become richer than any society ever conceivable in human history. And everything that we would like to have at every level of the income spectrum is, you know, in a sense, more affordable to us, again, with respect to any, you know, one particular family experiencing a crunch or a difficulty. This is part of the puzzle. This is part of the puzzle for demographers. How is it that children are sort of, they feel out of reach for people? And this is what I wanted to do, is go find out from people, well, what's driving you? Like, are you people, you know, have you discovered a place to live where it's just really easy to have children? Have you discovered like the trick to buying food for a large family? Like, what is the deal? And what I just kept hearing from people all around the country was really a story of, it's really hard. There are lots of sacrifices we have to make, but we just value these children so much. And these are the things that motivate us, these particular biblical principles. And then, of course, for many of them, after having a few, it was just this profound sense of joy. And so I would like to contrast, this is kind of, I think, as I understand it, a demand story rather than a cost story. In other words, and again, to be delicate, if we looked around and we saw a whole bunch of people who were struggling to get into shape, right? They couldn't get off the couch, and we would want to ask the people who managed to learn a new lifestyle. We would say, well, you know, this is a guy who used to be on the couch all the time, and look at him now. He's out walking miles every day. What motivated you? And, you know, you hear so often from people who make a change like that. They go, well, I thought about wanting to be there for my kids when I grew up, when the kids grow up. And so what motivates them to get off the couch is something really special. And you're not going to get that kind of change without finding out what's the motive, like what's the driver. And then when you look around and you recognize that in this country and, of course, across the West, we're experiencing a profound secularization where people are less and less identifying with the biblical values. And then you start to put it together. You go, oh, so we're becoming a lot less religious, and people are finding it a lot less easy to identify reasons to have children. It's a pretty compelling story.
It seems almost like there's a demonic attack on what God has intended as the basic building block, the fundamental building block of society, whether it's in the womb or whether it's towards people not getting married anymore or delaying childbirth until much later years, which precludes large families to a great extent.
I would agree with that.
I'd like to talk also about the practical aspects of this, because a lot of people, I'm sure some of them at least, are asking, can I handle this? How am I possibly going to handle the logistics of having a large family, 6, 7, 8 kids?
Almost nobody that I talk to, set about to have a huge family or a large, or even a larger than average family. They just set about to have one. And with one particular pair of interviews, these lovely Jewish women that I talked to, they said, just have one more than you think, just one. And I think that's really the right approach. People sometimes say, I could never have 8. And I said, well, I didn't have 8 all at once either. I just had one at a time. There are things practically we could talk about, and lots of people do actually. Once you sort of scratch the surface, you find out there's a lot of people out there sort of sharing tips and about the logistics of having a larger family. But the main thing to remember is that it's just one at a time. And you don't have 4 until you've figured out how to have 3, and you don't have 3 until you've mastered 2. On that point, I'll just say one thing, which is that I've even noticed on Twitter the last few days as people have been sharing this point, but there was a pretty shared sense across the interviews that about three children is the hardest number of children to have. Mm. It's not as if 8 is, 2.5 times harder than having 3. In fact, having 8 is probably easier than having 3, especially for, most people, your first 3 are, under 5 years old and you've got 3 little kids. That's really, really difficult. But what kind of universally I heard was that, 3 seems like you just can't manage it and it's a struggle. But then what happens is you do break through and you have your 4th. Well, by that point, that oldest child is helping in different ways. And then when you have your 5th, the older 2 are helping. And then at some point, you don't even have to do the entertainment of your younger children because the older children are, reading and playing with the younger children. And then, then there's this kind of this whole culture in the home that makes the things which seemed impossible, like how do I entertain 3 toddlers at the same moment? It just melts away. You're never doing it again. So there are things that are maybe unexpected. There are things you have to learn along the way, but there's other things that really don't get harder. You just change.
There's something else that I hear a lot from families, large families. It has to do with the social perception. And actually, at least here where we live, which is maybe not quite as family friendly as some other places around the country, they would go to the store and kind of be sneered at or scorned. And I'm kind of wondering about the social impact and if that is a factor for these mothers, particularly who have many children.
It didn't seem that it was off-putting, meaning most of the people I talked to, had gone ahead and had their families anyway. But I did record some of the more shocking stories that I heard. I asked everybody. In fact, I use it as an icebreaker. I didn't know these people. I found them in the ordinary way that researchers do. You put up flyers and you try to recruit people into a survey. And the goal is not to pick people that, your 5 best friends. So I didn't know them. So it's an icebreaker. When we began to talk, I said, what's the most memorable thing anyone's ever said to you in public about the size of your family? And a couple of the stories were heartwarming and nice things. But depressingly, large number of these memorable things were really negative. People commenting about how they're horrible people and they ought to be ashamed of themselves and that sort of thing, which is sad. It obviously reflects a lack of knowledge about things, and maybe just also I think a thing that is striking is that people that, you know, strangers would feel kind of free to go up and say things about your, you know, your marriage and your intimate life.
The Shilling Show Unleashed podcast continues with our guest, Catherine Pokolic, in just a moment.
Online at shillingshow.com.
Shillingshowmedia.com is your one-stop shop for websites, audio and video production, and photography.
Shillingshowmedia.com will take your project from conception to completion.
Shillingshowmedia.com is reasonably priced and highly professional.
Need a website for your business? Visit Shillingshowmedia.com.
Need a video created or edited? Visit Shillingshowmedia.com.
Have a photography or graphic design project? Visit Shillingshowmedia.com.
Shillingshowmedia.com is your one-stop shop for websites, audio and video production, and photography.
Visit Shillingshowmedia.com. That's Shillingshowmedia.com.
Shilling Show Unleashed.
Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. We're talking with Catherine Pokolic. The book is Hannah's Children, The Women Quietly Defying the Birth Dearth. This is such an interesting subject, and I just love that you wrote this book and took so much time with these various women. I'm very curious about, again, the changing of our society and people looking at children as somehow anti-environment. I'm sure you heard this and thinking that this is bad for the earth to have so many kids or to have kids at all. They're foregoing childbirth because they think it's bad for the earth.
I heard this from a lot of people that they felt that that was, you know, as to what we were just speaking about, part of the reason people would criticize them in public, you know, you're ruining the planet, that sort of thing. But some of the women remember, you know, hearing that in college or in high school, even themselves being more or less persuaded that that was kind of, it was irresponsible to have, you know, children at all, or one or two children would be irresponsible. There's different ways to think about this. I mean, you mentioned earlier some kind of demonic attack, and I think I would certainly want to agree with that sense, but we could look at that too from sort of a perspective of these kind of academic elite really fallacies about the world. And they've been around for a long time, and we could go back to people like Thomas Malthus, but I mean certainly in our lifetimes, I mean the influence of someone like Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb, which was certainly when I was a kid in the 80s, oh man, we heard about it all the time. Famine and disease, and it was all like just around the corner. Was we were just gonna sail off into the distance of just destruction because of you know, people having two or three kids. You know, that just, it needs to be trounced. It's false. It's been false since the beginning. It wasn't even close to being right when Paul Ehrlich said it. And it just won't die, right? It just, that's the part about it that seems maybe a little bit demonic, because it's demonstrably so completely false. And it just keeps coming back, right? It's like whack-a-mole.
How about family input? And I'm thinking primarily of people who are having large families who came out of smaller families. Is there pressure within the family to stop or put the brakes on?
A couple of the women did talk about that, how maybe the biggest source of stress for them early in their family, early in building their families, had been parents who just didn't understand, and, you know, who kind of had a set view, like this is, you know, there's going to be two grandkids and we're going to put money aside or whatever that is. Like there's this planning mentality, right? Which, you know, again, I want to be cautious. I'm not advocating recklessness, but I mean, there's a kind of planning mentality which has infected our culture. And so it's been cultivated, and this is the sense which I can kind of sympathize with the grandparents. It's been cultivated that the responsible thing to do is to have X numbers of dollars in the account for each kid. And then if your kid comes home and says, well, you know, we're going to have six kids, and the grandparents are going, wait a second, like we can't make a bank account for six kids. It's not part of our plan. There were stories of that kind of like initial resistance on the part of family members who had it all planned out. In all the interviews I had, I believe that the end result was kind of understanding that people had broke, you know, that it had worked out, that the grandparents had come around, you know, had come to see that this was great and actually a real blessing, but that there was a real initial hurdle, especially when couples were building a very different life from what they had come from. And often that was the case. So I think there was some resistance that I heard about, and I would attribute it to this general problem. I would say that this general problem is like the sense that children need to be kind of planned and fitted into this like overall plan for your life that subjects the goodness of children and the timing of children to kind of our own, like, building our life. And there's a way in which that's a good thing to build our life or to have goals. I mean, of course, I'm not against people working for goals. We've become very specific, right, about like the right time to have a child and all of the right things to be in place, when we know so much of what becomes good in human life comes in a sense out of God's bounty and in ways that are unexpected. And children, it seems, maybe one of those things. To contrast that, I think the women that I talk to really seem to push back on the idea that we've gone maybe really too far down this path of like planning it out exactly.
I'd like to talk about the impact of availability of birth control, in particular in the 60s, and maybe contrasting what was typical in the 1950s and then how things changed going forward.
It's going to take us a while to make sense out of the dramatic shift that occurred in the way we plan and think about our families. We really want to look at the birth control pill as the real inflection point. It's not that there wasn't birth control before the pill, of course, lots of things, but the pill is so much more convenient and so much less intrusive, it seems, into a couple's intimate lives. The birth control pill was approved, depending on which exact date you're looking at, right around 1960. And if you look at surveys of its use in American society in the 1960s, we see that the pill was just like there was a massive uptake. And in other words, like everybody wanted it very quickly. It didn't need to be forced on people. It didn't need to be kind of incentivized. It was something that once people were aware of it, it was very widely popularly adopted. Then what you see downstream from that within a decade, within 10 years, is you do see fertility intentions and also desires drop. So where people would have said in the 1950s that they would like to have 3 or 4 children, you started to see that decline through the end of the 60s and into the early 70s. And at the same time, you see the major inflection point of women entering the labor force. And that inflection point, meaning it starts in the 60s, and this is what I mean here, is married mothers entering the labor force. So the pill really, it has this enormously dramatic effect on the labor market participation of married mothers. Some people will say, well, what about the Industrial Revolution? I mean, that really pulled women out of the home. I mean, it pulled single women out of the home. If you really want to look at the change in married women, it's the pill. I think the key thing, I think that people think back about, well, how does this affect? We know that married fertility, the number of babies married mothers welcomed after the pill decreased pretty significantly. What I think some insightful comments about this, that basically prior to the birth control pill, people got married and they had children. I kind of the way we did, they just kind of had, they got married and said, well, we're not waiting. We're going to have a family. And they, you know, they might have 2 or 3 or 4 children. And then people will say at some point, people face that question, you know, should we limit our family? And there are different things people did to limit their families after 3 or 4, whatever that looked like. And we know, large families weren't unheard of before 1960s. But after the pill, it was increasingly the case that what people did was they got married and they waited. They got married at the time that seemed right to get married, but then they postponed that first child or, you know, until a degree was finished or another degree or a particular period of time in the workforce. And that seems to have been a really profound change in the family formation habits of Americans. And we see this today, right? So most people getting married don't see getting married as identical with the time to start your family. There's getting married and then there's when do you start having children. And that's just a fundamental change in human life that is hard to overstate.
I'm very curious, Catherine, if you noticed a dichotomy between secular versus religious and conservative versus liberal, in other words, in political and faith-based divisions in family size or the openness to having large families.
I didn't really have much ability to find people on the basis of their political points of view. And I actually didn't ask people. So if it came up, I learned about it, but I didn't ask about people's political persuasion. I did meet one family where it was very funny. The husband greeted me at the door with a MAGA hat. So I did know at least that family. this was in 2019. So I did see a little bit of that, but I will say that certainly things that came out of the interviews would have indicated that most of the people I was speaking with were fairly socially conservative. They're pro-life. People mentioned things like abortion as being a problem and a scourge and maybe part of our lack of openness to children. But I will say that I did a little bit of research into family formation and family size and just voting patterns around the country. And I sort of tried to sum this up at the beginning of the book a little bit. And what I found is incredibly surprising that, in fact, since the 1990s, more traditional families, married families with several children, correlate in a county, a voting county, correlates really strongly with voting, you know, for Republican candidates going back to the 1990s. It kind of emerged, this split. You know, again, it's not a perfect correlation, but it's a very, very strong predictor of whether a county will deliver its votes to the Republican or Democratic candidate. Going back, we start to see this emerge in the 1990s, and it became even more profound through the early 2000s, and then it certainly carried strongly into the Trump election. What does this mean? I don't really know. And of course, people move around, you know, a lot. So it's not as if it means that counties are stable in terms of where they deliver their votes. It's the strongest correlation that we know of in terms of predicting votes at the demographic level is sort of more traditional family formation and more children. So I think that some people have noticed this kind of divide. But I think it hasn't been talked about enough, and I'm not quite sure that I'm able to kick that off. But I'm hoping that comes out of this book and the kind of subsequent conversations.
Finally, Catherine, where do we go from here? Yeah. It certainly appears around the world, places like Russia, Japan, but even here in the United States, that population is collapsing at an alarming rate. What do things look like down the line in a generation or two?
Real quickly, it does look like, I think we're going to be facing some really sober economic and political consequences. I mean, economically, you know, countries will collapse. I mean, well, at least they will contract. Talk about like basically depression type conditions for years, because you need to have people to have growth. So economics will start to contract. Politically, the support of large government programs, the government budgets will have to collapse and shrink rapidly, as there aren't as many taxpayers and working taxpayers putting into the government programs. And then, of course, you know, just the human scale of the loss of brothers and sisters and cousins. I think that something is pretty depressing about that. Countries are shrinking, and they're going to be shrinking. More of them are going to be shrinking. We know lots of them are shrinking. And basically, I think you said, where do we go from here? I mean, there's sort of two paths into the future. One is, you know, trying, I would say, desperate and probably ridiculous ways to get people to have children. Lots of countries are trying this. They haven't really worked very well in the past. You know, paying people, you know, sending, you know, extra checks, giving them discounts and things. But I'll just say, between us, the other path is for Christians to work harder to evangelize men and women of faith who see children as a blessing. That's really the most powerful mover there is. So I'm really quite optimistic, actually, that, you know, it might take 100 years to shift the needle through policy, but I actually think evangelization, telling the stories of our children, telling the stories of our faith, this could be a much bigger driver and can move a lot more quickly. So I'm optimistic, but we have to understand the sources of, I think, family revival. I think they will come from faith and not from policy.
Catherine Pakalik, if people would like to get a copy of your book, Hannah's Children, or if they would like to follow your work online, would you tell us how?
Amazon is a great place to find my book. It's available on Kindle and Audible and the book form. And online, I'm on Twitter at CR Pakalik.
It's a fascinating book. I'm so glad you took the time, because I know it was a labor of love to write this book. Catherine Pakalik, thanks for joining us today on the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast.
You're welcome.
That concludes another edition of the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Visit us online at shillingshow.com, where you can directly support this podcast by clicking on the Patreon banner at the top of the page and making a monthly donation. Your support is essential for the continuation of the Shilling Show Unleashed podcast. Until next time.